Thanks very much, Vincent, for that reading of God's Word. So, when I came to this particular chapter, which I had was assigned to preach on, I did find myself thinking, what is there new that we can actually speak about this morning? Because in one sense, it's just a repeat of chapter 4. The guys getting refused to bow to the idol that that the king has created, and so they get thrown into a pit, and they get saved, and then the king ends up praising God, and it's a sort of almost like a repeat of that. This time it's not into the pit, it's not into the sort of the furnace. It's now into a pit of lions and so on. So the question really was, what are we going to say that's new this morning? And I must admit that as I came to this particular passage, I suddenly found that actually there's a lot of good stuff in here that I hadn't recognized before. And I want to share some of those things with you. This is not just a story for children. It's also something for adults. It's got a lot of good things, lessons to teach us. As we've already observed in the earlier chapters, chapters 1 to 5, we've recognized that these Jewish exiles were carried off from Jerusalem by the king, by the Babylonian king Nebuchadnezzar. They were carted off and they were taken, displaced to this faraway land. And here they were made to serve in a pagan world, in a pagan culture, were made to serve a false god. I beg your pardon, a pagan king. And one of the questions that must arise in people's minds when that happens is, well, how do you do this? How do you live out your life as a follower of God, as one of God's people? How do you live out your life in a situation where you're in a pagan world, serving a pagan king? How do you do that faithfully? And that's the sort of question that I think we as Christians also find ourselves asking as we recognize that we are living in an increasingly secular world. How do we do this? How do we live this Christian life so that we're actually faithful to God in our situation? And so I think this particular chapter has a number of lessons to teach us about that particular question, answers that it gives. So by way of introduction, we take up the story in the last chapter, at the end of the last chapter. Got to go back just a couple of verses to verse 30 of chapter 5. And Belshazzar, the previous king, has behaved badly. He's been holding this incredibly big banquet, 1,000 of the nobles with all their wives and concubines and so on. They've all got pretty drunk on all the wine that's been sort of flowing. And along the way, Nebuchadnezzar starts getting a bit silly and suddenly says, hey guys, why don't we bring out those golden goblets and silver goblets that were actually taken from Jerusalem, from the temple in Jerusalem. Why do we take those and why do we drink out of those? What's the point of them sitting in that storeroom just gathering dust? You need to remember that these were the sacred utensils from the temple. And when we talk about sacred, you need to think of something like happened with me this morning. So I went into the bathroom, I had a shower, and then I went for my favorite towel, which I've just recently bought, red one. It's sort of really fluffy. And I found that actually somebody else in the family had actually used it. Do you know what I mean? It's my towel for me, and they were using it for themselves and doing what... Now, I'm not going to sort of make any accusations, but you know the sort of feeling. And these goblets and the silverware and so on, they were sacred for God, for His use only, not for sort of mundane use at some sort of drunken orgy. And so that would have made God somewhat angry. But to make matters even worse, what starts happening now is that Belshazzar starts singing the praises to the gods of gold and silver and brass and so on. Starts praising these gods that can't hear, can't speak, are dumb and stupid, and they start praising and worshiping these instead of praising and worshiping Yahweh. And so as a result of their stupid behavior, God's judgment falls upon them. Well, particularly upon Belshazzar. And you find that there is this prophecy that's made over him that very night, Belshazzar, king of the Babylonians, would be slain, would die, and that his kingdom would be lost to him. And that's actually what happened, we're told in verse 30. He was killed, and his kingdom was taken over by Darius, who was the ruler of the Medes and Persians. Now, it's really interesting, actually, to do some sort of comparison with what happens with some of the historical documents that speak of the same sort of period. What we know is that Cyrus was the king who had incorporated or had brought together the two kingdoms of Media and Persia and had made them into one great big kingdom. And they'd come down from the north or from the east and had basically invaded Babylon. And basically had taken Babylon quite easily. In fact, we have information from some of the historical records that the people of Babylon actually welcomed them. But the folk who were in the actual Babylonian city, in the capital, felt quite secure because the walls were immense and there was no way, they thought, that anyone was going to be able to have to find their way in. But what Cyrus did was he diverted the river that fed the moat along the western wall, and they were able to gain access from there. And so it came as quite a surprise. And we're told by one of the historians that actually the place was invaded during a nocturnal festival, I quote unquote. So that fits with what we see happening here. Another historian, Xenophon, he states that the Persians killed the Babylonian king, and he describes the Babylonian king this way. He says he was a righteous, indulgent, cruel, and godless young man. And all of that seems to fit really, really well with what we know from Daniel. There are other accounts, I must just let you know, that other accounts that sort of conflict a little bit with that information. It's really hard to work out what the truth actually is. But one of the big questions is, who's this Darius? Because that Darius doesn't fit with the historical records. Who was this Darius? We know who Cyrus was, the king of the Medo-Persian Empire. So who was Darius? And there's a lot of stuff being written, a lot of suggestions made. But I think the one that is most reasonable, the one that I will follow, is that actually Cyrus and Darius are in fact the same person, two names. The one name possibly from his Median background, because he had ancestors who were Medes. And then Cyrus was his Persian name from his Persian side of the family tree, as it were. And so Darius and Cyrus I take to be the same person. The other bit of history that's rather noteworthy is that the takeover of Babylon, as I said, was rather easy and straightforward and without too much commotion and too much bloodletting. And that would explain why the structures of the government structures in the previous regime were able to continue right the way through, pretty much unchanged. That's why we find Daniel still in a position, the high position of authority, as the new kingdom is established. He's one of these high up civil servants, and that's continued through from before. Which brings us really to the first lesson that I want to share with you from this passage for this morning. And the first lesson that I take from Daniel's example is that we should seek to excel even in places, even in work which isn't specifically Christian, even in activities which don't necessarily promote directly the cause of Christ. Wherever you are, in whatever situation you find yourself, you really should be working at it with all of your heart, so that you might glorify God. And you can see that in the way that Daniel approaches his work here in this chapter. He applies himself to his work with great diligence. He's one of the three administrators over the whole kingdom. And when we talk about the kingdom of the Medo-Persian kingdom or the empire, you might be inclined to think of a superpower like America or Russia or China. Wrong. Think of all three together. It was an enormous kingdom. It was a kingdom that had no rival. It was massive. And here's Daniel. And he's one of the three most important rulers, apart from the king, in that particular kingdom. And He seeks to serve his employer, in this case the king, pagan king. He seeks to serve his master in a way that honors the Lord. And you can see that, as I say, in the way that he acts. Have a look at verse 3. We're told that Daniel so distinguished himself among the administrators and the satraps by his exceptional qualities that the king planned to set him over the whole kingdom. It's really, really impressive in the way he goes about his work. And then when his colleagues try to find fault with Daniel, they could find none. We told verse 4, they could find no corruption in him because he was trustworthy and neither corrupt nor negligent. Hey? What a testimony to his application to his work. So the fact that you might only be engaged in secular employment should not mean that you should give it any less of your heart and soul, as it were. That you should not apply yourself to it. What I take from Daniel's example is that whatever situation you find yourself in, wherever you are working, whatever your context, you should really think of it as serving the Lord himself. And that's a principle that we find carried over into the New Testament. So in the New Testament, Paul is writing to slaves of all people and saying, even at the level of slave, you really should serve your masters, not just to please them, but as if you were serving the Lord, not men. Ephesians chapter 6 and verse 7. And that's a really, really good attitude for us to take into the classroom, for example, or into the office, or on the workshop floor. I'm not serving men. I am not serving my employer in this. I'm serving God. I'm doing this for his approval. That seems to me to be something that Daniel models. This is a subject that I'm studying at uni. This is an engine that I'm fixing as an apprentice. This is a sermon that I'm preparing, and I'm doing it as if the Lord were marking my paper, or as if the Lord was paying my wages. I'm serving him. That seems to me to be the first lesson that we can take from this particular chapter, Daniel 6. The second lesson that we learn from Daniel 6 is that if we live out our faith in a pagan world, inevitably we will win friends. But we will also make enemies. And I think you can see that also from Daniel's own example. It's obvious that his dedication to his work, the way that he went about his business, the way that he served his master, had in fact won for him a friend in the king. It's clear to me from the passage that the king actually has a strong attachment, has a real affection for Daniel. So much so that when he realizes Daniel has been caught, as it were, in a trap, or the king and Daniel have been caught in this trap, he does everything that he can to get him out of it. And when Daniel is finally thrown into the lion's den, the king is obviously agitated. He cannot sleep or eat. He's desperate to know if Daniel has survived. Verse 22. So you can see Daniel's godly behavior has won for him a friend, at least in the king. But it also made enemies for him, and you see that also in the chapter, in the passage. You can see that particularly verses 4 to 9. And there are a number of reasons of why he has made enemies. There may well be something of a racial prejudice here. You know, who's this Jew coming from another place and trying to tell us how to live our lives? We don't need that. Could have been something of that there. The king plans to promote him so that he would be ruler over everyone. And obviously the other administrators would have been jealous of that, and also the satraps. There's also a suggestion in verse 3 that Daniel was in fact clamping down on corruption. And that wouldn't have won him many friends, particularly if they had their hands in the till. Would have been another cause of resentment. All of which would explain why these administrators and satraps were out to get him. Listen, we can't have this foreigner ruling over us any longer. We need to bring him down. But the problem is how. And often often there is some sort of parallel here in terms of our own experience of life in a secular culture. The other day, we're doing a little bit of we're moving a house, another little house onto our property, and I needed to find out how deep the sewer was, so I had to lift up the manhole cover, and as I did so, there were these thousands of cockroaches just clinging to the walls of the actual sewer manhole, and you know how I love those things. They live, listen to me, those cockroaches are living on poo, and then they fly into your houses and they walk over your tabletops. I do not like these things. But in this manhole, they were there, and as soon as you open the manhole, they just go scurrying for the dark because they hate the light. It's like, don't like the light. And there's something of a parallel there in terms of working in a secular world. I'm not saying that people who aren't Christians are cockroaches. Please don't. I'm not saying that. Please. It reminds me of that movie District 6. But I'm not saying that for a moment. But what I am saying is that our neighbors, people who are not Christians, often are resentful of us because in some sense, if we live faithfully for Christ, if we live godly lives, there's a sense in which we shine a light on them. And if they're involved in bad stuff, it shines a light on that, and they don't like it. And it also highlights the superficiality of their belief system, of their worldview. You know, why are we here? Just to have a party, just to have fun, get drunk. And what happens when you die? Well, when you die, that's it. And what Christians do is they say, but isn't it more than that? And they don't like that. They don't like being challenged about the things that they think and the things that they believe. And it's a shining of the light on them, and that's why they get angry. But the thing that people often particularly dislike from a pagan world about Christians is their commitment to Jesus. I mean, it's hard to understand exactly how this works, but here's Jesus, and he's an incredible person. He's one of the most beautiful characters he is the most beautiful character who's ever lived. He's left us with the most profound words ever spoken. He identified with the poor and the disenfranchised. He healed the sick. He showed love to the lost and to the needy. He powerfully restored people back to health. And he gave people hope for the future. And Christians are resented for following him or for mentioning his name. And you say, go figure. How does that work? What's that about? So I think the lesson that we learn from this is whatever you do, do it as unto the Lord. That's the first lesson. But the second lesson is just know this. When you do live faithfully, you will make enemies. You will find that there will be resentment directed against you. It's inevitable. And that brings us to the third lesson that we learn from Daniel 6. And it's that, Rico Tice helped me to see this. I haven't recognized it myself, but I'm sure it's true. There is something of the demonic in this, if you look more closely. It's not spoken of, Daniel doesn't mention it directly or explicitly, but I think it's there when you see what's happening here. I mean, how sinister, how corrupt, how deceptive this plan that these administrators hit upon. They could find no fault or corruption in Daniel because he was trustworthy and neither corrupt nor negligent. So let's nail his faith in God. So Darius, why don't you make a law that says we should only worship you, don't worship any other God, including Yahweh, just worship you. I mean, what a sinister, devilish plan they've hit upon. And I really think it does have all of the fingerprints of the demonic upon it. And it's no different to what Paul says in Ephesians 6. Our struggle is not against flesh and blood, but against the powers of this dark world and against the spiritual forces of evil in the heavenly places, in the heavenly realms. And that is something we need to remind ourselves of continually as Christians. There will be some people who will resent us, and they will show us an irrational sort of hatred and anger on occasions. It just won't make sense. You'll sort of think, what did I say that made them so angry? And you need to remember, there's a spiritual dimension to our engagement. Your adversary, the devil, prowls around like a roaring lion seeking someone to devour. And so that's the third lesson. We need to remember that there's always a spiritual aspect in terms of what's happening around us, in terms of the antagonism that is shown, that is directed at us. The fourth lesson that we learn from Daniel 6 is that there will be occasions when we do need to obey God and not men. Yes, it's only right that we engage fully in our culture. There is no place for Christians withdrawing to their Christian ghettos, hiding away behind their walls, saying it's a dangerous world out there, we need to protect ourselves. I just do not think you see any of that here in Daniel or anywhere else in the New Testament. There's no place for that. We need to engage fully with our culture. We need to be fully involved. But there will be occasions when we need to say enough is enough, and that's going too far. There need to be occasions when we say, yes, we know that this is what the authorities are saying, but we have a higher authority who we ultimately are responsible to. And you can see that, I think, in Daniel. You can see that in his response to this edict of the king. When he hears this draconian law that's being promulgated, and I want to just basically, I'm using an illustration that I got from Charlie Skrine, but because I think it's quite useful. So I'm just going to parody this a little bit. So what happens when he hears that this law has been issued? What does he do? Well, he goes back to his house, his home. And your feeling is, well, that's safe enough. There's bound to be some room, dark room downstairs where you can hide away and do your stuff, you know. But he doesn't. He climbs the stairs. Daniel, what are you doing? I mean, there's a death threat against you on this issue. So he doesn't hide away in the cellar, but he climbs the stairs and he goes to the uppermost room and he stands in front of the open windows. And you say, not wise, Daniel, don't do this. This is crazy. Don't you know that they're looking for an excuse? Close the windows. And Daniel gets down on his knees. Why would you do that? Why not just sit in a chair and have a magazine on your lap and people would think you're reading? He gets down on his knees, and he doesn't just pray at 5 o'clock in the morning when everyone's asleep, but he prays 3 times a day. And what Daniel is saying, in effect, is, yes, I understand the authority of the king, but I have a higher authority, and I must refuse this particular law. And I don't know about you, but I'm challenged by Daniel's example. Because I think often in our own culture, we're too ready to hear the command, you know, jump, and we ask how high. And maybe we need to start listening more to what is God saying and what is our higher authority that we need to be listening to. So, let me give examples. How do you feel about the nurse who's ministering to a terminally ill patient who asks if she can pray for her and as a result loses her job? How do you feel about that? We know of a young Christian psychologist working in Queensland who was counseling at at-risk young people in a government institution, and she offered some spiritual advice, Christian spiritual advice, to a young person who had identified herself as a Christian. And she was told in no uncertain terms, in future, leave your faith at the door. How do you feel about that? All references to Christianity, as we've often pointed out, are regularly edited out of stories that are aired on the TV. And I wonder if there are Christian reporters and Christian newsreaders who've objected to this bigotry on the part of the media, this intolerance on the part of those who claim to be so tolerant. And how about the law that punishes doctors for refusing to carry out an abortion because they believe that it's a child? It's not just a fetus. And there's no good reason for the abortion to proceed. And they suffer the consequences. And you can think of examples in your own lives, occasions when you have needed to stand and to say, yes, I stand for Christ, in whatever context it might be. And you fail to do so. I'd never shared this with you before, but it is rather amusing, in a way, sad. Where a bunch of students were involved, we're in a class. This is at the uni, UQ, and the lecturer from the front, large class of students, the lecturer at the front said, are there any Christians here? And they knew his attitude to Christians, and they remained silent. I'm sad by that. We need to have more of the spirit of Daniel in us. We need to listen to God rather than to men. Now, in a moment, I'm going to conclude with this, we're going to be celebrating the Lord's Supper. And so the question, I suppose, does arise, and I've been asking the question myself, does this chapter have anything to say about what we're going to be participating in a moment? And I know that there will be some of you who will be rolling your eyes saying, oh, Spency, you can't find Jesus where he's not present. Don't try and find him here also, please. But bear with me, if you would. There are so many parallels between Daniel and Jesus. I don't know if you've noticed that. Let me take you through them just very briefly. Evil men conspired against Daniel as they did against Jesus. When Daniel is faced with the threat of danger and possible death, what does he do? He prays, which is exactly what Jesus did when he knew that the cross was what lay before him. He goes up to the Garden of Gethsemane and he prays. Daniel is found guilty even though he is innocent. When the king says, what happened? Daniel explains to him in verse 22, I was found innocent in God's sight. I've never done anything wrong before you, your majesty. He was found guilty even though he was innocent. And that's the same story with Jesus. Does the story sound familiar? Jesus, who did no wrong, was condemned to die on a cross, even though he had lived the perfect life. Most intriguing of all, Daniel is cast into a lion's den and a stone is rolled across its entrance. But there's more. A seal is placed on the stone so that no one can come and tamper with Daniel. Sound familiar? Jesus was placed in a tomb and a stone was rolled across the entrance of the tomb. And it too was sealed to prevent the disciples from stealing the body. Angels were present on both occasions. It's mind-blowing stuff, isn't it? Everyone, including the king, expected to find a dead body, a mauled dead body, in the den. But instead they find Daniel alive and well. And similarly, the woman who went down to the tomb of Jesus were expecting to find a limp body. But instead what they found was a resurrected Savior. Jesus is alive. He's been raised from the dead. Now, I know it's not a perfect fit. I know that there's no sense in which Daniel bore our sins, as it were, to death in our place. That's not true. But what I love about this and so many other of the stories that we find in the New Testament is the way in which God has laced his word with these pictures that speak of a bigger picture. This is not just the only, there are so many. I was listening to a series of sermons on Isaiah, and it was absolutely amazing how Isaiah speaks so clearly about the one who is to come. I just love that about the scriptures. And what they do is they allude to a much bigger story, the story of Jesus, of the Christ who carried my sins to the cross and suffered and died in my place so that I wouldn't have to suffer for them myself. But he did not stay in the tomb. He was raised to God's right hand where he sits in glory. And God now calls on everyone everywhere to believe in Jesus. That's how you find forgiveness. That's how you reconnect to God. That's how we enter his family, how we receive the life that he gives. And those are the sorts of things that you desire, that we all desire. Aren't they? Well, then in that case, you need to come to Jesus. You need to put your faith in him. Amen.